From Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, this is East Central Europe Past and Present. Occasionally, we invite visitors to our campus to present their work on East Central Europe and interact with students. This blog series will bring you their views on the past, present, and future of the region and how scholars approach it. I'm Holly Case, and today we're welcoming Elizabeth McGuire, who got her PhD from Berkeley in 2010, this year. And she's now an Academy Scholar at the Harvard Academy of International and Area Studies. The title of her book manuscript is The Sino-Soviet Romance, How Chinese Communists Fell in Love with Russia, Russians, and the Russian Revolution. And I wanted to start, Elizabeth, by asking you about how it is that you came to this topic. If you could tell us a bit about your scholarly intellectual path to this this history.
Sure. I started out as a Russia specialist, both as an undergraduate and then in a master's program. And in the master's program, I, on a whim, took a class on contemporary China. And it had an introductory section about 20th century Chinese history, about which I knew nothing. And I took the course, and it was mind-blowing. It was a complete epiphany because I saw so much that seemed so Soviet. And as though I did know that there was a large geopolitical history about Sino-Soviet relations, what I couldn't understand was what I saw as a kind of deeper, almost more cultural and social connection between these two revolutions. And when I looked for literature about this, I didn't find anything, and I became very fascinated. And then, as I began looking into the more social and cultural aspects of Sino-Soviet relations in graduate school at Berkeley, I just fortuitously happened on a beautiful memoir by a Chinese woman who'd been born in the Soviet Union to two Chinese parents but had grown up completely Russified, and then returned, quote-unquote, because she'd never been to China in 1949 after the Communist Party took power, and the story of her tortured relationship with her Soviet-educated but yet very different Chinese parents. And so it was sort of geopolitics writ small, and it was a fascinating story. And from there, I began interviewing more and more people like her and uncovering then a whole history of romance between Chinese communists and the Russian Revolution in the 20s and 30s that since, you know, is not something that anybody ever discusses. You hear a lot about the divorce, the split, but nobody ever talks about the romance. And so then I, you know, as I uncovered more, at first I thought these might be just a few scattered sources, but as I did more and more research, I found both in archival documents and in memoirs that there was a saturation of romantic images. And so that's where my project began.
Maybe you could give us a few examples of where you see the macro linking up to the micro in some of the things that you've seen.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are so many of them, but maybe one of the most dramatic ones is the case of Chiang Kai-shek and his son Jiang Jingguo. And I'm going to talk about this today here at Cornell. But this is a wonderful case of Jiang Jingguo, the son, spent 12 years in the Soviet Union from the time he was about 15 till 27. His father sent him there to study, and he became a pawn in the geopolitics between Stalin and his father. But then at the same time, he himself lived out the Soviet experience between 1925. He Russified completely, married a Russian woman, collectivized a Russian village, worked at Uralmash, worked at Dynamo factory in Moscow. And so he had this Chinese, this ultimate sort of symbol of the future of the Chinese nationalist revolution was actually off in Russia having a Russian social history. You know, you could, if you just took away his name, you could write him into all of the historiographical work that's been done about new Soviet man. Mm-hmm. And yet he turned out to be, and so for him, the geopolitical dimensions of his life were constantly intersected with the everyday dimensions in ways that just made his life into this complete, almost the perfect juxtaposition of these two things. So, for instance, in 1927, when his father massacres his erstwhile Chinese communist allies, poor Jiang Jingguo, who is a communist or is very leftist, is in Moscow and has to hear about this. And, of course, everybody is burning in effigy Chiang Kai-shek, and here's his son in Moscow, and he has to get up and in front of all of his classmates, and then it's published in Pravda as well, renounce his father and say, you know, Chiang Kai-shek was the friend of the revolution and he's no longer my father. And so here is this very, you know, this compelling individual story that can be written into social history, and yet at every turn has these massive geopolitical dimensions. So that's, I can't remember even what question you asked, but.
No, that was a good answer. So the next question I have is about some of the practical concerns or challenges of writing transnational history of this sort. So, I mean, you mentioned that you took this course and that you were really interested. That was probably step one.
Yes.
On a longish journey. And maybe you could talk about, you know, how you see some of the practical challenges to going about writing transnational history that crosses traditional area studies boundaries as your work does. Mm-hmm.
This is a topic that I could probably talk about for 3 hours and bore you to tears with, because when I first started to be interested in China, I just acted as if my interest did not exist. I tried to squelch it, repress it, because I knew it would mean that I had to learn Chinese language, and I was in my late 20s, a time when you don't think about learning a completely different, new, super hard language when you're starting grad school. And in fact, when I applied to grad school, I didn't want to mention my interest in China. I was afraid I would appear flighty and unfocused, and, you know, so I applied just as a Russianist, even though I was harboring this secret interest in China. And so I got a fortune cookie right as I was starting to study Chinese that said, "A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step." And I literally taped that to my computer, and I sat there in my Chinese classes, which were very, it was basically, I decided that to do what I was trying to do, I had to accept the fact that I was going to look and feel stupid constantly. And to this day, even, because what happens is as you diversify your focus, you do learn more and more. Your store of knowledge is growing and growing, but it's growing in multiple areas. And so it's, by definition, less in depth on each area than somebody who spends all of their time on that area. And so the challenge is the pressure. Here's my biggest problem is the pressure I'm feeling to declare myself as one or the other in this case. It's not as easy as, you know, with Russia and China. Those are two such well-defined territorial separate fields that don't think of themselves together. And so it's different than if I did say, you know, like, a lot of people studying Russia now are studying the former Soviet republics and their languages and things like that, and that would be an easier combination. My problem is I'm constantly feeling pressure to either drop the China side and just do Russia, or drop. I would never drop Russia. I could never do it. But in my heart and mind, I could never, ever do it. But to sort of go for China, when really what's fascinating to me, and every project I ever conceptualize is always a project that takes either both Russia and China, or sometimes I include France because I do have some French, you know, I have good French language, and so I always want to do comparative. I kind of want to rewrite Theta Scotchpol 100 times in 100 different ways. And so I can't conceive of a project that didn't include them. So I figure I just have to just withstand the pressure.
Perhaps you could tell us a bit about, because your dissertation is also innovative or original on the narrative level, and how you approach narrative in your work and how you see it connecting to the transnational nature of what you're doing.
That is a super fantastic question, because nobody's ever asked that to me before, and I think, and I never thought about that, but the minute you asked it, I realized how important the narrative was to this transnational thing. Because the problem is that you have to get readers from, say, in my case, at least China and Russia. You know, of course, I'd hope that people, that I'd have even a broader audience. I want a very broad audience. I always did. I wanted to be a writer before I decided to go to grad school. So for me, writing was always just, I love to write. So, and I love to write stories. And I think in terms of stories. So that's natural to me. But when you ask that question, I realize something really important, which is the narrative is crucial because I need to engage people and convince them to take the journey. So if it's a China person, I need to engage them and convince them to come over to Russia where they don't usually like to go. And Russia people, I have to engage them and get them interested in these Chinese people who normally they just, for Russian studies, you know, there is general curiosity about China and a general feeling of, gee, I wish I knew more about China, but not the kind of curiosity because Russian scholars, I think, following their subjects are often very focused on Europe because Russia always wanted to be part of Europe. And, you know, Russians themselves don't look upon China with great romantic, you know, my dissertation is about Chinese communists falling in love with Russia, not Russian communists falling in love with China. Mm-hmm. So I have to capture those Russian audience. And so I have to have characters and I have to have a good narrative plot line and I have to tell a story that stands on its own. And thereby, you know, thereby cross that transnational divide with my narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're kind of entering an era in some respects that is post-area studies or reconfigured area studies since the collapse of communism and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. At least area studies for our region has has flown apart or has changed, let's say, radically. And I was wondering how you imagine the historian of the future in a post-area studies world and how you see your work fitting into a kind of post-area studies conceptualization of the way that we write history.
That's a really, really tough question because when I think about, for me personally, I just wish it were okay for me to have this dual interest and that there'd be flexibility in the way academies are structured so that it would be all right for you to be two things at once. And yet, so I have my own feelings of frustration or just hope that it will become increasingly okay to do the kind of thing that I do and that I will not be asked repeatedly in applying for jobs or even just choosing where I would publish something or the audience for a book or that I would be able to constantly conceive a broad transnational constituency for what I'm doing. So clearly, and yet on the other hand, when I imagine a world where I've thought about it a lot, should say history departments just start advertising, I wouldn't want them to advertise thematically. I think that would really lead nowhere. And you can't take away, you can't just advertise a job and say, we're hiring a historian. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, maybe I guess I would just maybe hope that the definitions of what it meant to be a scholar of, you always start somewhere. So if you started as a scholar of Poland, that it would be increasingly all right if for some reason you found this wonderful connection with Paraguay, and that wouldn't really detract from things. So I wouldn't want to completely take away, but I just, when you see jobs advertised as, you know, a this and such period of this and such country, and it's very specific in terms of its periodization and its geographic specificity, I guess I would like that to get a little looser. Mm-hmm.
So how do you think, in light of this, we should be training graduate students in terms of, you know, to create this or to make room for a post-area studies generation? Or, what technically speaking, should training in history look like today, let's say, for someone who is thinking about going into the profession?
Mm-hmm. Well, in my case, I have a very clear recommendation, which is, it used to be that if you wanted to be a Russian historian, you had to learn Russian, French, and German. And so you would, and depending how you came into your PhD program, you'd have to acquire those languages. In my case, I started and I took one semester of German, and my heart was so into China at that point, I just dropped it and started taking Chinese and decided that I would forever after suffer. And I do suffer, but I intend to learn German and I think I can do it, you know, when I need to. So I just think it should be Russia, for instance, for Russians, because that's where I came from. I would say the rule should be Russia plus two. And I don't care what two it is, you know. If you choose to, in fact, fantastic for people to still choose French and German and keep that, you know, that strain of the historiography alive. Like that, in fact, I think it's sad now that Russia, that, you know, a straight Russia topic is increasingly, I find it refreshing when someone comes with an absolute straight Russia topic. That's great. But I just think in Russian studies, for instance, it should be Russia plus two. And I think in a lot of different cases, you ought to be allowed to have a base, because most of us come in with a base of something. We had an undergraduate experience. Maybe we spent 3 years teaching language in a region. So we all come into graduate school, I think, with an area where we feel kind of familiar. And I think we should be required to strengthen that area and to be, you know, very credible in that area. But then I think we should be allowed to develop these other interests and not to have such close stricture on what those are. Mm-hmm. But what that does for area studies centers, who knows, because then where do you affiliate? So even for me right now, as I'm entering my time at the Harvard Academy of International and Area Studies, I have to fight with my own schedule over how many Fairbanks Center China events I go to versus Davis Center Russia events I go to, and how I define myself in those communities. So I think it's a challenge that there's no answer perfectly to yet.
So with Russian and Chinese as, you know, two of the languages that you've got, or, you know, plus French, I was wondering, down the road, what kinds of other things do you think can be done with this particular language combination?
Well, I have several dream topics. My second project, I'll just say briefly because it's not a good answer to your question, but I'll say it because it is a second project, is about an international children's home that was in the Soviet Union for children of communists from all over the world. And I am imagining that I'm going to do some language acquisition in the process of that project. But that's an absolutely international project, because there are people that I will be interviewing who are from, you know, South America, from the Middle East, from Africa. So that is an absolutely international project. But I have two additional projects that really get, you know, get me going when I think about them. One of them is a typical kind of issue that comes up when you're writing your dissertation and you realize there's something out there that's fantastic that just is, there's no work on that's compelling enough for you. And that is the question of the political importance of Russian literature in China throughout the 20th century, and the whole process of translation of Russian literature into Chinese and reading practices, because there have been a couple of fantastic articles about underground readings of these horrible, boring socialist realists Soviet novels during the Cultural Revolution, because those were the only books, like, parents would look the other way when their kids hid under the covers at night and read these socialist realist novels in the Cultural Revolution. And so these became romantic novels for these young people. And so, and then repeatedly throughout the 20th century, politics is channeled through Russian literature again and again and again for Chinese in ways that are absolutely fascinating that haven't been. And there's starting to be in mainland China scholarship on this, but so there's actually a wealth of information available, lots of books you could start with just to kind of get going. And I think it would be a great study of literature and politics and geopolitics and construction of self, and, you know, it could bring in so many different things. And so that's the one project that I can see for myself. And then the other, my sort of dream project, the one I picture myself laboring over for years and years, is kind of a Theta Scotch Ball turned upside down project. And it would be broadly conceived as a comparative study of food and revolution in France, Russia, and China. And it would be covering all kinds of, I couldn't quite decide. It would be a long thing. It might be multi-volume. It could really, really go on, because I would like to do a very close comparative. I would like to do a series of comparative essays on very particular issues, things like restaurant culture or practices of starvation, or getting at this deep fundamental question of how much a revolution can really change in a society, and what the relationship between culture, revolution, social practices, you know, is, dealing with this, like, human thing, food, that's so, and I know there's so much being done on food, and it's a very popular thing to be doing right now. Maybe it's a little bit too trendy, but I think if you looked at it like you wanted to rewrite this issue of comparative revolutions from, you know, I'd also love to include some economic history in there. I have a little bit of economics background. So, like, food distribution. So what I would like about it is that you could bring in all different sorts of history, you know, social history and cultural history and even economic history and all of this, and then bring that to bear on this classic question of state and society and revolution in a comparative way.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, we'll look forward to
this in 38 years.
Yes. So I just have one last question, and that is, I mean, you have such fantastic ideas for topics, and you come to Soviet history and Chinese history in very unorthodox ways, and I was just wondering who you see as your primary influences, or what books you've read that have kind of set you off in thinking on this path, or that have been kind of models for what you consider to be, this is really great history.
These are always hard questions to answer, because I think sometimes the books that get you going the most aren't even the ones that are directly related to your topic, or, you know, you sort of get really, really, really worked up about them. I have to say straight off the bat, without any hesitation, that my own dissertation committee's books, I mean, I know that this is really, you know, silly to say, but I have to say, I had, my dissertation committee was made up of Yuri Sozkin, who wrote, you know, Arctic Mirrors and Jewish Century, very metaphor, you know, use of metaphor in history, and kind of looking at relationships between Russia and something else over a long period of time, and drawing a lot of interesting conclusions. And Wen Xinye wrote a book called Provincial Passages, which is all about how travel between, how not just time, but space can be revolutionary. So going from one place to another can be a revolutionizing. That was a huge influence for me. And Irina Paperno, my third committee member, who wrote a lot about symbolic behavior and sort of how people write themselves into, how people write, you know, revolutionary ideas into their own personal behavior. So, I mean, I can't not make that answer. But I would say that there are a couple. One of the most inspirational books for me was How Life Writes the Book by Thomas Lahusen, because it was such a rich combination of anthropological almost research, and it looked so deeply at questions of the relationship between history, literature, and politics in such an inventive, in such a good narrative way. And of course, the other person that I have got to say is Jonathan Spence, who's a historian, a narrative historian of China. And I literally, with Jonathan Spence, I would literally read his books and almost take them apart piece by piece, paragraph by paragraph, to try to understand how he made that narrative. Because it's not, you think you're just going to sit down and write a narrative, but the reality is it's a whole process learning how to do that. And I would literally watch, like, I can't even tell you how detailed my readings of those books would be, you know, because I was just trying so hard to learn how to write historical narrative.
Great. Well, it's wonderful having you here, and I hope we'll have future occasions, and I wish you all the best of luck now and in future.
Thank you.